STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
All right, friends, today's the day. I am so excited. Hey, welcome to the show, first of all. I'm Greg Kokel, the show is Stand to Reason. And I have been waiting, is it fair to say, like 15 years, Melinda? 15 years for this day. Melinda says, I've been waiting. Because she has been on my case, along with others of our staff, that to finally finish the project that launched today under the title The Story of Reality. That's the name of the book. Today, the 10th of January, is the official launch date, which means if you bought a book, say, through Amazon or something like that, this is when they ship them out, and this is the day that you can go to Amazon and put a review, tell the whole world what you think of the book. Of course, there is a whole lot of you, last count, 1,600, that we sent the book to in the month of December, and some of them are still going out right now because we had a tremendous response from our Stand to Reason crowd, people who sent a gift to us in December, and we sent the gift of the book to you to get it in advance of everybody else. So many of you have already received the book. Maybe you've read the book. And if you have, I'd love to have you go to Amazon and weigh in, or when you get the book, if you do and you read the book, then go ahead and weigh in and give your report and your point of view. I'm pretty confident that you're going to like it. And so if I didn't think you would were going to like the book, I wouldn't send you to Amazon to weigh in. But so far, all of the people who have weighed in have given it 5 stars. And I just looked at it a few hours ago, and that's the way it was. And I'll be looking at it again tonight. I'm just kind of following up, being excited about this launch. And those of you who received it, of course, or sent a gift in December for Stand to Reason, many of you received the gift, but what happened is we ordered almost 900, and I came in mid-month to sign all those books. Right when they landed on our doorstep, I was here, and I signed all of them, and we sent them all out, and there were still orders pouring in, so we ordered another, 800 books or so. I think the total was about 1,600 so far. I signed all of those last Friday, and those are all in the process of being shipped out. So we've been sending it out. They were all shipped out the same day I signed. So everything, that's how good of a staff we have, she says. And she's right. Well, I had to come in on a Friday against Friday traffic and sign all of that, but I was thrilled to. I was glad to, so that all of you who ordered books could get them as soon as possible. So many of you have already received, and many will still receive very shortly the books that we're sending out to you, and we still have orders coming in January, of course, and we'll continue to do so. It'll be a regular purchase order on the web. If you want to get the book, str.org, right there. All right, and we can send it to you. Now, some of you might want to go to Amazon and get the book, and I understand that. If you come to us, you're going to pay a buck or two more, but that goes to us. So it helps what we're doing at Stand to Reason, but that's your choice. So I just appreciate the activity anywhere because I think that this book is going to change a lot of people's lives. By the way, I would not say that to you if I didn't believe it. I've written other stuff that I don't think changes lives. I think it helps people and it's worth reading, but I don't think people are going to look back on the piece and say, boy, that reading that book reflected or resulted in a turning point in my own life. I think this is true of people who read Tactics, by the way, and I only say that because I've had a lot of people tell me that. And I think it's going to be true of the story of reality as well. The subtitle is How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. I just did my first interview with Janet Mefford, my favorite interviewer, and so I was glad to give her the very first interview. And she asked, how do you get all of that in one book? And I said, the key word there in the subtitle is Everything Important That Happens in Between. I'm focusing in on the things that have eternal consequence in the lives of people, and that's telling the Christian story. So that's the book, and I think that because the story itself is so powerful, the more that we understand it accurately, and there's a lot of books that tell it accurately, but we not only want to understand it accurately, I want to understand it. We want to be able to read it so there's clarity. Let me back up. There's a lot of books that give it accurately. Okay, not as many books give it with clarity, and still fewer do it persuasively. And these were all objects that I had in mind when I wrote. Now, you guys can be the judge whether I accomplished my goal. I'm pretty excited about how the whole thing turned out. But I think that it's not only going to be helpful for followers of Christ who have been around for years and who never had the big picture, and I know that because I've been teaching this material at churches under a different name. The name was Credo, C-R-E-D-O, subtitled The Story of Reality, but the main title was Credo. I've been teaching it for 15 years. And I have had people come back to me and say, why hasn't anyone explained it to me like this before? And so I go into the teaching thinking, now this is going to be boring because it's so simple, it's so basic. But when it's laid out in a coherent fashion so people see the big picture, and that's what the story of reality is about, is seeing the big picture, really, and the things in detail that really matter, the core pieces that really matter. When they see that, it just seems to come together for them in a way that it never had come together before. So if you've been around for a long time and you've got a lot of the pieces, maybe the most important pieces of the Christian picture, like a puzzle, but you've never put them together in a coherent whole, well, this is a story that will, an accounting, a book that will help accomplish that, okay? But this is also going to be for those who are younger Christians, that haven't got the whole story. They don't have all the pieces of the puzzle. I'll give you the main pieces. I'll give you the core substantial pieces that you really need to build a foundation on. And if you've been around for a while and you get it, you know it, this isn't new to you, you're going to be influencing people who are younger Christians. You may be a youth group leader. You may be a pastor. You may be a Bible study leader. You may be discipling. I hope you're discipling. We all should be discipling in some fashion, reproducing ourselves in the lives of others. Well, this is going to be a tool that I think will be a tremendous help to lay the foundation in the life of the new Christian or the growing Christian, the emerging young Christian. So it's going to be great for them. But you know what? I'll tell you who I had in mind mostly when I was writing this, and I don't mean I had them in mind because I want them more than anybody else to read the book. I want Christians to read it first. That's my target audience, my biggest one. After all, stand to reason, we train Christians. That's the first three words of our mission statement. We train Christians. So that's my heart, training other Christians. But I'll tell you who I had in mind, who I'm thinking of, is reading the book. I'm organizing the words and the order and the voice, if you will, and the rhythm and the language for non-Christians. I wanted to write a book that any non-Christian could pick up and wouldn't feel like they're getting a theological tome, wouldn't feel like they're getting a religious tract, wouldn't feel like they're hearing a bunch of the religious noise. That's what it amounts to them. When Christians rattle off the slogans about Christianity. Now, to Christians, it's not noise, most of the time, I think. It's meaningful statements, but to the non-Christian, it's not meaningful. It's just the slogans they've heard before, and it's like the Christian blah, 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 that's all. And so I wanted to write a work that sounded pleasant to the non-Christians' ears. I don't mean accommodating their fallen sensibilities. You know me better than that. I mean sounding like they could, in a way that they could listen to it without it being painful. And I think I did that. And if I did that, that's going to be helpful for not just for the non-Christians, but it makes it easier for Christians to read it as well. But what this means is if you've had a follower, a friend or an acquaintance or a family member that you've been talking to about the Lord and kind of, you know, here and there, on and off, you've been trying to put a stone in their shoe, is the way I like to put it. This may be something you could give them to say, look, you know what I've been talking about for a while? This kind of puts it all together in a way that's pretty easy to read. And also, just to let you know, it's got built in with it what I call a soft apologetics. That is, there's a lot of rationale why you ought to take this seriously that appeals to our common sense notions about the world. But it isn't polemical. It isn't argumentative. It isn't like, well, here's the 10 points. Bang, 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 bang. No, it's very accessible, I think. So that means this could do a lot of work for you with your non-Christian friends. In fact, Melinda just told me that we're working out something at the product side that if you want to get these in blocks of 10, you can get a discount for it and then hand it out to your friends, because I think this is going to be a great evangelistic tool, the kind of thing that is going to give you a foundation upon which to have very fruitful discussions with your non-Christian friends. So, I mean, these are all the uses, I think, that this work might have in your life. Now, as you can tell, I'm pretty excited about this because I've been thinking about this material for a long, 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 long time. And I will say, though, I've started 15 years ago on this, and we had a picture frame hanging in the office for years, which was the frame for the cover of this book, which had yet to be produced, and somebody had scrawled in magic marker the words Credo, C-R-E-D-O, because that was the original title. Like, when are you going to write this book, Kokel, so we can actually put the cover up here and have it done? But, you know, it's just, I thought about it for so long, and I knew I got to get to this. But at the same time, I had this sense in my own heart that there's a certain timing about these kinds of things. And I realized that as I was waiting and writing, rather teaching on this topic, that my ideas about how to present the material began to change slowly. And so this is a very, very, very different book than I had originally intended writing. Content, pretty much the same, but the voice and the approach and the organization and all kinds of stuff, very different. I had in mind a very, very left brain kind of treatment. And the way, when I started doing seminars on this, this is the way it was. And slowly, and I think even during the time where the whole emerging church kind of thing was happening, and there was all this emphasis on story and narrative, and sometimes an illicit emphasis, I think, on narrative, or application of the concept of narrative. Nevertheless, I realized that, boy, this would be a great way of a more effective way of communicating the details that I had been assembling and teaching on in the Credo material. Maybe I can shift and then call it the story and maybe work, you know, use that kind of motif. And that's why the subtitle up until about a year ago was The Story of Reality, the main title, Credo. And then J. Warner Wallace and I had dinner about a year ago, and he just pounded me with it. He said, dude, you can't call it Credo. It isn't going to work. Nobody's going to read it. Nobody knows what that means. You're going to get a couple theologians by it. He'd already read the earlier drafts. He said, this is good stuff. You want to title people that's going to attract people. And he convinced me over one meal, and that was it. And I abandoned that name and decided to take my subtitle and make it into the main title, The Story of Reality. And boy, am I glad that I did. And then I added the subtitle I have now, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. And that actually comes from the first paragraph of the first chapter. So this has kind of gone through a process of change and transition and the like. But I want to tell you very briefly, and then we'll go to break and go to calls because I got a lot of folks on board here that want to chat. I want to tell you very briefly the broader reasons that I was writing. I had two basic goals. From the outset, I was at 15 years ago, I was asking myself the question, what are the sine qua nons of Christianity? That is, those doctrines or those pieces of belief or the things we hold to be true that are absolutely core and essential, the sine qua nons, that without which you remove those things and you no longer have Christianity. What are the essential doctrines that every Christian must believe to be called a Christian? What's the core? What's the foundation? And I realized that I needed to build something like that, explain those basics. And I realized, well, I guess you have to believe in God, right? That's the beginning. It is the beginning of our story, but it's also the beginning of our foundation. And, I mean, without God, we have no story, okay? But then there are things about man that are critical, man's beauty and man's brokenness, man made in the image of God, but man terribly fallen. And then there are things about the rescue operation, God becoming a man. Who was the man that God became? What is vital about that? And that is the person and the work of Christ. Jesus is the God-man. And what he did, he lived the perfect life that we should have lived, and then he died in our place, substitutionary atonement, very important. Then he rose from the dead, and we are to put our trust in him. These are all vital pieces. And then at the end of the age, a final resurrection to either perfect justice or perfect mercy, and the whole problem of evil resolved. And so this gave me the pieces that I began to work with in my earlier iterations of it. But as I talked about these basic truths, and these really played themselves out in the five main points that provide the structure for the book: God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection. The five words that are the backbone of the plot of the story, the most important things that happen in the order that they took place: God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection. So now I've got the structure there, okay? Now I want to develop it. But I wanted to do this, of course, in a way that was memorable and accessible, so that's why I have the simple structure, the book built around those five words that tell the most important details of the Christian theology in the story in the order they took place. But secondly, it was the style. I wanted to have a kind of a storytelling voice. So in this book, I talk with the reader, so to speak. I'm not just laying information out like in some articles you just say the stuff. But there is a sense in which I'm addressing the reader. And this I picked up from C.S. Lewis. I have another writer friend who says that this is called a fairy tale, the style. So you see this in The Hobbit with Tolkien, this style. You see this in the Chronicles of Narnia by Lewis. You see this in John MacDonald before Lewis, or George MacDonald, rather, before Lewis. This engagement with the reader and walking with the reader through the narrative. And so that's the style that I adopted, okay? The second thing was a different aspect. I wanted the first goal to have that basic doctrine, that core sine qua nons of Christianity, in a voice that was accessible and easy to follow and read, fun to read, so to speak. But secondly, I wanted to drive home the point that what I describe in the book is not religious fantasy, not a once upon a time Marx's opiate of the people, but rather an accounting of the way the world actually is. Now, many Christians, non-Christians for sure, have lost sight of this, but many Christians have lost sight of it too. They relativize their own view. This is my religious view. They look at it from the inside out. This is my belief. This is my relationship with God. Of course, all of those things are true, but notice that's the inside out, from the personal perspective. Jesus saw, his worldview, I was going to say Jesus saw Christianity, but that would be anachronistic a little bit. But Jesus saw the project that he was advancing from the outside in first. That is, it was a characterization of the way the world out there actually was. And if it wasn't a characterization of the way the world out there actually is, then it's meaningless. It's useless. It does nothing for us. People have a way of relativizing religion nowadays. It's your truth versus my truth. But as I say in the book, look, if the story is not accurate to reality, it's not any kind of truth at all. So it can't ever be my truth or your truth, even if we believe it. It can only be our delusion or our mistake or our error, but it can never be our truth, not if it's not true, okay? And so I want people to see that the claim of Christianity is that it's true in the deep sense, and if it's not, it doesn't solve anything. Even if you feel better believing Christianity, that's not good enough if it's not actually true, capital T. And so I guess, you know, for me, the story of reality is a kind of mere Christianity for a new generation if the comparison doesn't seem too bold. It's a wide-angle look at the Christian view of the world and the meaning of the drama of human history in a voice that's conversational, not religious, soft apologetics mixed in, and answers, one last thing here, and then I'll move on to your calls, answers two problems that are huge stumbling blocks for Christianity in general and therefore for Christians. And the two biggest problems are the problem of evil and why Jesus is the only way of salvation. Those are the two biggies for Christianity, historically speaking. And what I want people to see, especially Christians, is that these two biggest objections to Christianity are not the problems for Christianity that people think they are. That a proper understanding of the story shows how these fit together and they complement each other. I think this is a book that will help the reader understand Christianity in a way they've never had before. Help them to see how it all fits together. And even better, I think they'll see why we can be so confident that Christianity is actually true in the deep sense, that God is real, that heaven is real, along with hell, that Jesus really lived and really did the things the Gospels record, the resurrection really happened, and there is hope for eternal life you can really count on. It is, after all, the story of reality. Okay. So there's my little pitch and introduction. Time for a break, and then we'll go to your calls on Stand to Reason. Stay with us. I have been working on one of the most important projects of my life for over a decade now, and it's finally come to press. It's called The Story of Reality, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. Now, The Story of Reality is a kind of a wide-angle view of the Christian story. It's a big-picture description of the meaning of the drama of human history. And it's meant to cover the basics of Christianity from a worldview perspective in a voice that's really conversational, not religious. It's kind of a mere Christianity for a new generation, if that comparison doesn't seem too bold. Now, I tell the story using five words that capture the meaning of all of human history from its beginning to its end. God, man, Jesus, cross, and resurrection. The narrative, it's infused with what I call a kind of soft apologetics, that is thoughtful reflections that are not argumentative, but rather are friendly appeals to common sense notions we're all aware of that point to the truthfulness of the Christian story. I think you'll find The Story of Reality to be, as Lee Strobel put it, a beautifully crafted description of the Christian worldview written in an accessible, winsome, and well-reasoned manner.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org, and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's Mentoring Letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STRE News from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. And by the way, I didn't mention the audiobook for The Story of Reality. I actually did the reading on this. I did not do it for Tactics, and I have people tell me that whoever did the reading did a good job for that. But I had an opportunity to do this reading, and I thought, well, I'll tackle it and see if it works out. And it was challenging, let's put it that way. But I'm glad I did it. The reason is because, as I mentioned a few moments ago, I think the voice of the writing style is really important. And this material is my material, and I really care about it. And I'm talking to you as a reader. And so I thought, you know, I understand the way these portions of the book should be inflected a whole lot better than any other reader, even a really good reader, because it's my stuff, it's my heart, and I know what I'm trying to get across to you as a reader. And so I decided to go through the tedium of doing the reading, and it only gets hard after about 3 hours. It gets really hard because then you end up making a lot of mistakes and there's a lot of pickups. But anyway, I just mentioned that because if you're thinking about getting the audiobook, you'll get me. And most of you are listening here are used to my voice anyway, so I think there's a good fit there. All right, let's go quickly to, number two. There's nobody on number two. Number four? Okay. All right, this is anonymous apparently, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Hi.
Sorry.
That's okay. You scared Melinda there. She jumped. Welcome to the show. We had the wrong numbers up on the post. That's why I had a little trouble there. But welcome to the show. I'm glad you called. Hi.
Thank you.
You're welcome. What's on your mind?
My question is, can I get some biblical guidelines for single people who are caring for older parents as far as I guess boundaries and how much you should do with them for them, because I know for married people, their marriage and their family is priority over the parents in some ways.
Yeah.
But for single people, there is not that. So I'm in a position where I'm caring for one of my parents who is not well, and it's very difficult and sometimes verbally abusive sort of,
right,
or just angry sort of situation, and the other parent is trying his best to care for her, but they're both very stubborn, and they are at times often very unwilling to work with me in the things that I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty much exhausting myself trying,
right,
to care for them, but they're not cooperating, and I just don't know where the boundary line is. I live with them. I live downstairs from them. And so I'm here, and I'm the one who, I don't mind doing everything I can for them because,
sure,
I love them, but they're not cooperative,
right,
at all. And everything I suggest to them is not taken, and it's just a very poor situation, and
yeah,
I just don't know where the lines are.
Right, right. Well, wow, that's a complex situation, but I don't think it's rare, to be honest with you, because people get old and they need help, and families that are conscientious want to do what they can. And Christian families ought to be conscientious because the Bible teaches very clearly that we have responsibilities. And I'm looking at, for a passage in, that I thought it was in Second Thessalonians 3, but without kind of quoting chapter and verse in every case, the point is, we know this, that the first commandment with a promise is the commandment to honor our father and our mother. Now, honoring looks different as time grows on, and I think that part of that means that we are helping to take the responsibility for our family members, younger and older. I think of the passage in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, wherever it is, if that's the right passage, it talks about we have an obligation to take care of our own families, you know, and families are extended in many cases. This was the pattern and the habit of in the biblical times. So I think the biblical issue broadly is one you already take seriously, okay? The question becomes, in the particulars, how does this play itself out? And this is where it isn't so much that the Bible, I think, says things like, well, do it only this far and then you're off the hook or whatever. There are biblical principles that may be helpful, especially in the book of Proverbs, where wisdom, wise guidelines are given for dealing with people that might play in here. But your circumstance is, what you're facing is, you're doing, as far as I could tell, what God wants, in the sense that you're taking your responsibility to for your parents seriously. I do not think this always means that you are the caregiver for your aging parents. And so maybe what I might be able to help you to do is to take a little pressure off of you regarding this issue. My this issue strikes a little close to home to me, because just a little more than a year ago, my mom passed on at 84 or 85, and for much of that time, she was under the care of our family, principally my youngest sister, Bonnie, and she lived in the house with Bonnie. And one of the things that we had to deal with was the wisdom of the care being given by a family member in the home. That can be an overwhelming circumstance, and it sounds to me like it might be getting that way for you. Sometimes it's overwhelming because of the nature of the care that has to be given. Maybe parents aren't ambulatory, or they can't feed themselves, or their bathroom functions and bathing need to be cared for, and then this becomes almost a full-time way of life for one of the children of the parents to manage that. Sometimes, if there are other siblings, this responsibility can be shared, but usually it falls to one person if one of the children is doing the caregiving. Sometimes the demand isn't so much the physical problems, like I just described, not being ambulatory or caring for themselves, but it's emotional problems. You've got crotchety people that don't appreciate the unbelievable sacrifice that is being made on their behalf. And that sounds to me, from what you've described, is part of the problem here.
Yeah, and I'm trying to help my dad, and he does not understand that he also needs a break, and I'm willing to give him those breaks, but he's killing himself trying to do everything, and we are trying to help him, but he's not cooperative either. So,
what do you mean, like, he needs a break? He's trying to take care of himself in ways that he's not capable of taking care of himself, or he's trying to take care of your mom in ways that are overwhelming?
Yeah, he's trying to take care of my mom, and she's, you know, she can walk around. It's nothing physical, really, like, as far as that. But he's doing everything in the house, taking care of my mom by himself. He never leaves the house except to go to the store or to the bank. He never takes a break. He's he's just stuck in house all the time, and she's very, very difficult. And I have told him, I will be here. I am here.
Yeah.
You know, go take a break, go out somewhere, go do something,
sure.
Rest your mind. And neither one of them listens to anything I say.
Okay. Is she lucid?
Sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but your dad is lucid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I can see that the strain is getting to him. He's starting to not act right, and
sure.
I know that it's because of the stress.
Well, let me offer a couple of thoughts. Here's a very, very broad principle, and this applies to all relationships. You can't force people to do something they don't want to do. Most of the time. Now, if somebody is in a very dangerous situation, you know, then you can be more aggressive with them. But you know, when you have people that are reasonably lucid, ambulatory, and you're taking care of them, and they don't want to do what you want them to do, then they're just not going to do it, and there's not much you can do about that. If you say, "Dad, look, you're working too hard. You never get out. I'll be here. I'll take care of it." And he said, "No, I'm going to stay." Well, in a certain way, he's digging his own grave, and I don't know how you could, I don't know what else you could do. You could be more insistent. "Dad, leave. Here's $10. Buy yourself a, go out to dinner down the street with your friends," or whatever, you know. So you may be able to encourage him in a good way to get out just so he gets a little bit more rest. But if he doesn't want to follow that instruction, well, I don't know what else you can do. And the same thing with your mom. You know, I don't know. Now, what you can do, though, is you can set up some boundaries. And you can say, here are the boundaries. That there are certain particular things you may be able to control with regards to circumstances that represent boundaries that are protections for you in the circumstance. Now, there's a whole series of books about boundaries. And I'm trying to remember the authors. Melinda's coming in here. Yeah, Henry Cloud, and he's got a...
yes, I remember those.
Yeah, and now he's got a bunch of books about that is boundaries for different kinds of relationships. So go to Amazon and just check out his series of books and try to see which one seems to most parallel the circumstances that you find yourself in. Because sometimes you might have to say, "Mom, I'm not going to let you do that, or I'm not going to respond to that, or I'm not going to participate in that," or whatever, because you're setting a boundary, okay, that is important for your emotional health and your mother's emotional, maybe physical health, too. So it's fully appropriate to set boundaries. I can't recommend those boundaries for you and your circumstance because I don't know your details, okay? But that would be a resource that you could go to, and it's they've sold... Henry Cloud and his co-writer have sold a gazillion of these books because they have been so helpful for people in abusive circumstances to establish boundaries. By the way, are you an only child?
No, I have a sister. She does what she can, but she works full-time, and so she can only be here sometimes in the evening, but she needs to be here more, but she also understands that they are difficult, and so she's, I guess, smarter than I am. She knows that telling them things doesn't work, so she doesn't try as hard as I do, I guess.
That's a healthy realization. I mean, if what you're doing is breaking your back to get an approval, want mom to say, "Hey, you're doing a great job. I appreciate so much." Well, they might not be able. It's a legitimate desire, but that may be something you're never going to get, and so you're going to have to set your sights a little differently.
Yeah, no, I don't need that. I just want them to be safe and all right, and I don't want my father to go absent. I want to take care of my mom as long as I can, and it's just, I don't know, I guess it's okay to set boundaries? I don't know.
Oh, yes, it is okay to set boundaries in all relationships. No. Listen, this is a very important thing I'm about to say that actually applies in a lot of different circumstances. There is a difference between self-interest and selfishness. There is a difference between self-interest and selfishness. There are all kinds of things that are appropriate for you to pursue that are in your self-interest that are not the vice of selfishness. I have no sense from what you told me that you are a selfish person.
I'm trying not to be.
Well, it's pretty clear to me that you're not. But that it is not selfish to set boundaries. It's not selfish to say, I can only do so much. It's not selfish to do that. It is self-interested, of course. But sometimes people want to make that into being selfish, and that's not the case. And this is something the Boundaries book will help you to deal with. Now, there's another book that I found very, very helpful. And in fact, every member of my siblings, every one of my siblings read as we were considering the care given my mom. And what we ended up doing with my mom is she ended up going to a facility eventually. After 5 years with my sister, she went to
a facility. And that's okay. That's acceptable.
It's more than okay. Yeah. It's usually the absolutely wisest thing to do if it's financially feasible. And we made it happen. I mean, my mom had some resources, not too much. There was some aid that's available, government aid. She has five kids. And so, you know, we all did different things to try to make this happen as best we could, and we did. And we realized that it had gotten to a point. Actually, we should have done this move probably years before we did it because it would have been healthier for everybody involved. Everybody intimately involved with that circumstance, that created a lot of hardship and difficulty because I think partly, I'll just say frankly, it's the standard response. The feeling was, gee, if I don't do everything that I physically possibly can do, then I'm not being a good child, I'm not being a good caregiver, I'm not being a good Christian, and that is a lie. This book that I want to recommend is called The Elder Care Handbook. Elder Care Handbook. Did you read that too, Melinda? Because Melinda faced the same situation with her own mom, who's now gone. I did with my mom, and my wife and I did with her mom, who is now gone too. And different circumstances require different things. But one huge point the Elder Care Handbook communicates is that no child has the responsibility to give full care to their aging parent. There is a responsibility to the parent, but that responsibility can be fulfilled in different ways. And many well-meaning children are motivated by both love and a sense of guilt that if they send their parent to an institution, they have somehow abandoned their parent. This is the way they put things in their own mind. But these elder care homes sometimes are wonderful places where your parent can get better care than you're able to give. And disinterested parties, in other words, ones that are not emotionally involved, are in a better position to put the kind of boundaries there that are necessary. So here's what I recommend to you, dear heart, is that you get a copy of the Elder Care Handbook and get a copy of one of the books on Boundaries by Henry Cloud and his partner, and you and your sister read both of them and use the very wise things that are said in those books to begin to formulate a working plan for the circumstances that you're facing. What do you think?
Okay, my parents always said if you send me to that place, I'm going to die. They would always say that, so I always have that in mind. You know, yeah, if we send them away.
You listen.
She will never forgive me, and she will die, and it will be on me.
Right. Oh. Well, listen, your parent, this is the kind of guilt trip that, you know, unfortunately sometimes gets laid on children, okay? That is not the way you make the decision. This is just causing destruction. And it is not good for elderly people who don't have good judgment to be in control of everything because they're obnoxious. It's not good for them. So hold on just a minute. The enforcer has another thought for me. Go ahead. Right. Right, right. Melinda says there are family support groups, too, that you can go online and find that can help you with this. You are too alone in this. You are just too alone in this. And your sister, God bless her, wants to help, but she's not giving you much because her circumstances are demanding as well. But this, I think this will give you some direction for your circumstance, okay?
Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling. I'm glad I had a chance to talk with you.
Okay,
all right, bye-bye, dear. Well, that dear woman is not the only one in a circumstance like this. That book was called The Elder Care Handbook, and the other books are the Boundaries books by the authors I mentioned, Henry Cloud, and we'll have the details later. It'll be posted on our blog. Amy will do that for us. So, all right, let's take a quick break, and I'll be back after this.
Do you have a friend, family member, or coworker who identifies as gay or lesbian? Or do you find yourself in conversations about the topic of homosexuality and want to make a productive contribution? Well, if you're either of these people, chances are you're wondering how to navigate those conversations and how to navigate those relationships in a healthy way, but without compromising your convictions. Well, I want to tell you about a new resource I've made called The Truth About Homosexuality, A Compassionate Response. And it's a DVD that includes the most comprehensive presentation of my teaching on this topic that I've ever presented. In this DVD resource, I'll present the truth about what scripture and science says about this topic of homosexuality, but also show you how to communicate it in a persuasive yet winsome and gracious manner. So I hope you'll consider this resource to help you elevate your understanding of this topic and make your conversations with friends and family who identify as gay or lesbian to become more Christ-like.
It's hard to keep in mind all the facts and arguments you need to address tough topics. That's why STR has developed a series of quick reference guides on same-sex marriage, abortion, and tactics to help refresh your memory and encourage dialogue. These guides give you concise answers, all on a single 8.5 by 11 inch laminated card. They're a quick and easy way to gain useful knowledge about some of the most important issues facing Christians today. With these tools at your side to guide your thoughts and aid your memory, you'll engage critics with full confidence. You'll be fully equipped to answer objections with grace and clarity. Get your quick reference guides today by visiting the STR store at store.str.org or calling 800-2-REASON.
Greg Kokel back at you here on Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Tuesday night from 4 until 6 p.m. And, of course, you can call in if you're listening at other times in the podcast. Obviously, you can call in at that time, Pacific time here in Los Angeles. 855-243-9975 is the number. Hey, look at in a couple of, let's see, weekend after next, I will be in New Braunfels, Texas. I think that's the San Antonio area at Christ Presbyterian Church. There's a Francis Schaeffer conference there I've been asked to speak at, and have I been influenced by him. So I'm looking forward to that. That's on the 20th and the 21st of January. And the 29th, I'll be at West Jackson Baptist Church in Jackson, Tennessee. Then in February 4th and 5th on that weekend, Parksville Fellowship Baptist Church in Parksville, British Columbia. That's Vancouver. And then on the 15th, that's midweek, actually, at Living Oaks Community Church at Newbury Park. That's my church in the Thousand Oaks area here in Southern California. And we're actually doing a series there. You might want to check it out, Living Oaks Community Church, Newbury Park, because I'll be third in the series, and there are a lot of other really good speakers that are part of that on successive Wednesday nights. And that series always sells out, so you want to check that out. All right, let's go to our buddy Jordan. And Jordan in Ohio, nice to chat with you again, buddy.
Hi, Greg. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. So what's on your mind today? Well, we got 10 minutes. A little less than eight minutes till the top of the hour. We go out at 57, so we got, about 8 minutes.
Well, the question, the main question I wanted to ask was why Jesus' sacrifice was necessary.
Okay.
I've heard multiple perspectives on that, but I was curious what you thought of it, and I have a perspective that I wanted to just kind of throw out there that I thought was kind of interesting, and I wanted to get your response
sure.
to that.
Sure. Yeah. Of course. I'll simply put. And I do talk about this in The Story of Reality. Did you get a copy yet?
I'm thinking of getting the CD, yeah.
You're thinking of getting?
I haven't ordered it yet.
All the conversations we've had, you're thinking. Well, the part of the reason I like you to get it is, I encourage you to get the book. I mean, you can get the CD if you want. You can listen to it wherever. But, I mean, books, yeah. You are serious about this. Jordan, you talk about this, you think about this, we've chatted on this many times. I want to encourage you just to, and it's not so I can sell another book, that's not my project. It's so that you can look at the pages and write notes and underline and mull it over. And you can't mull over what's on a CD in the same way you can on the written page, okay? But in the book, I talk in some detail about this. So I'm just going to scratch the surface here with you, but a simple way of putting it is that we, you and I, all human beings, owe a debt. You notice whenever somebody commits a crime, you probably heard people use the language, well, he went to prison and paid his debt to society. Have you ever heard that phrase before?
Sure.
Yeah, it's a little bit quaint and antiquated, but it's people still are aware of it. The idea is that we owe obedience to appropriate authorities, okay? And when we violate our obligation, there is a debt that needs to be repaid, okay? And that debt is by way of punishment. Now, people nowadays don't think so much of it that way. They like to think about it not as punishment. That sounds too much like revenge to them, and so they think about it like, well, rehabilitation. But that's not my view. I think people who do bad things ought to pay. They should be punished for them. And I think that's sound. And this is also the biblical perspective. And so since we have accrued a debt, that's one. It's the language that we see in the discussion about this in the story, although it talks about it from a number of different angles. This is one of the angles. That debt needs to be paid. And this is an onerous debt. It's a debt that the only way we can properly engage it is by an eternal separation from God, banishment forever to a place of misery. Okay, so God made provision for a rescue, and he became a man to pay the debt himself on our behalf. Almost a grotesque oversimplification would be if you got a parking ticket or a speeding ticket, and what it amounted to was a fine, I could pay the fine for you. And you would be off the hook as to the payment because I made the payment for you. The state is satisfied because they get their payment, and you are happy because you experience mercy at my hand, not at the state's hand. So there's just a simple little metaphor of the kind of thing I'm talking about. The reason Jesus had to die was because of our crimes against God. We are guilty. But because of love, God made provision for us to be rescued from the penalty of our guilt by taking the penalty on himself. So there, in a few words, is the answer to your question from the biblical perspective. This is why Jesus came, why God came in the person of Jesus to earth, is to rescue us by making a trade his life for ours.
Okay. I like the analogy you made with the whole parking ticket thing, because that would probably help illustrate a question I have.
You know what? I'm looking at the time. I talk so much. We got about a minute and a half. Well, why don't you ask the question? It may be better for me to pick up from this point next time that we talk, which I'm sure mm-hmm. will be next week, probably, because we talk pretty frequently. I took a little bit of time in explaining that particular detail just because I think it is so important. It is so foundational. It is so core. And I think it is frequently, I don't even want to say misunderstood. It is frequently not understood. And I don't even know that all the Christians that you talk to have a very rich understanding that this something like this had to take place in order for human beings to be freed, because God is a just God. And in his goodness, because he's good, he can't let guilty people go free. Just like the police force in your city, if somebody came in and did some awful thing to you or to your family member, and the police force, they caught the guy, and then you go into the station, they say, where's the guy? And they say, well, we let him go. You're going to say, why'd you let him go? Oh, because we're loving. I don't think that's going to satisfy you. I think if they let him go, given what he did to you and your family, because they say they're loving, you're going to say, that's not right. That person should pay for what that person did. I think that's your intuition. And that's exactly what I'm saying.
If you don't mind, I think I would like to touch on the analogy you used, though, with the parking ticket, and that, as you say, like, say I got a parking ticket and you decided to pay it for me.
Right.
It's not so much that my debt would be paid off as much as transferred. It's kind of like instead of owing it to the state, I'd owe it to you then.
Well, no, you wouldn't owe it to me because I did it for you, so you don't incur a new debt. You might consider yourself, in a general sense, indebted to me, which would be entirely appropriate, and is exactly the way Christians feel with regards to Jesus. Somebody who's deeply indebted to somebody else, even though they don't owe, that is, to pay back, what they end up giving back is gratitude. That's what they give back. That's the natural response. Thank you for doing this for me. Thank you for paying that debt. Thank you for suffering, in the case of Jesus, on my behalf. I don't owe anymore. I don't owe, in the parking illustration, I don't owe the debt to the state. And in the illustration with Jesus, I don't owe God. I'm just grateful for what he's done, and I could never pay it back. And that's kind of the way it works for Christianity. Listen, got to go, Jordan. Great hearing from you again. And next time we talk, let's pick it up from there, and we'll talk some more. But get the book. I'm going to ask you next time I talk to you whether you got it or not. All right, thanks a lot for the call. That's it for this hour, my friends. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.